What I'm handing around is a page from Harris.
On the transition.
And it's close to the account I ended up with last time, but I thought, let's begin with just another account of the transition, the end of self, the end of the unhappy consciousness, transition to reason, and then I'll just open it up to anything you want to talk about. Any questions, textual, general, anything. And we'll just go until the wine runs out. Harris claims that, I think, roughly, there are four steps involved in the transition from the unhappy consciousness to reason. Step one, end of the first paragraph on page 435. I give up my will, but I can only do that by accepting a higher will altogether. The mediator is essential because only through his otherness can the otherness of this higher will be explicitly presented. It is only my voluntary surrender that makes this higher will possible. But if my surrender to God did not take the form of freely abdicating my autonomy of decision in favor of another, like myself, this higher will could never become a real positive will at all. Thus, the last act of the devout singular consciousness is the establishment of an authority recognized as universal. So the first step, remember my suggestion was, against Butler, that rather than seeing this as a work of a self-defeating performance of another kind, the trick here was to ask the question of how the idea of God, the idea of the universal, right? God is just a stand-in or representation of what? For us, of the transcendental ego. For us, there's nothing higher than the transcendental ego. Right? So by God, we just mean a transcendental ego. Universal synthesizer. And the question is, that originally appears as God. So the question is, how does God's authority as universal will enter the world? First thing to be said is, I have to abdicate my will to another. But not to any old other, but to another like me. Right? So I'm now really back in the world of the master-slave. Finally. We've now got my self relationship as mediated by another. Just so happens the other's a priest. It doesn't matter. A priest by any other name is just a guy in a frock coat, right? All that kind of stuff. Now, so we're back doing what the slave did, right? Only now, wine and pizza. I'm advocating my will to another like me, willingly. That is, I'm now willingly recognizing the other as representing my universal will. That's who the other is. My better half, literally. My true self, my essence, in fact.
Now, how
does God, priest, other, get their authority? All their authority, not their status as universal, but their authority comes from my abdication. I make the other possible, just like the slave made the master possible. Right? It's just a repetition of that move. Right? Only now I'm thinking in a different version. Namely, I am recognizing not the other as what I would strive to be, but as my true self. So I abdicate my will to this higher will. So I is now, if you want, just to keep the translation going, I'm now something like the empirical ego, and the other is something like the transcendental ego. So I recognize another part of myself, right? And it's my recognition. That's all this is. Abdication is another word for recognition. I recognize myself in the other. And so thereby authorize that other. Make it possible for the other to enter the world and have authority. Their authority is, as I abdicate my will to him. So this is what the incarnation promised. God becoming man. This is how it works out in practice. Step two, next paragraph. Third sentence, according to what we can see, however, it is only the willing surrender of the sinner's self-will that makes it possible for God's will to exist at all. So if you remember, at the end of the master-slave, Hegel kept saying, you know, the problem is if you don't do actions. I mean, the problem has been throughout. Let's think of it this way. The series of performative contradictions by the unhappy consciousness have arisen because every time I attempt to denounce myself, I've been asserting myself. So the problem of the unhappy consciousness has been a problem of unintended self-willing, self-assertion. And it's unintended simply because it thought it could will to give up its body, to give up its willing altogether. Now it's willing to have a higher will. So the claim then is that the surrender of the sinner's self-will is what makes it possible for God's will to exist at all. How does God enter the world? Because I listen to him. Because I act in his name. Because I give up my will and I do the willing of God. That's it. There is no other authority possible. So self-willing overcome, I guess, by surrender.
Similarly, in giving up possessions and enjoyment, the penitent consciousness takes itself to be only giving back to God what is His.
Now, this is important. What the self-will does by surrendering is give to God, which is essence, what belongs to essence.
Namely, its authority. So this act is how I authorize universality. But universality always should have been two things linked together. Always should have been both universality, that's easy, and will. That's what was missing when I tried to surrender to universality. I was trying to surrender to an abstraction. Remember the ding, 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 and all that, you know. Our problems with mysterious abstractions, universality, a mysterious Christ, the empty grave, all these things. What I didn't recognize is essence has a will of its own. But if it has a will, then of course it must also be particular. Hence, step three,
next paragraph.
But this identity of my will, so now we have an identity.
By abandoning my will to God's will, I create an identity of my will with God's will. Identity with the difference, because I've abandoned myself.
So an identity of identity and non-identity. But this identity, my will with God's, of my being for self, with objective universal.
So what we've done here is infused the notion of universality with subjectivity. This is a moment in which Hegelianese of substance becoming subject, of what is universal, having a moment of being for self. Right? That's the two things that are being joined here, in itself and for itself. So, my self-willing is my for itself, right? And the moment of universality is essence is the moment of in itself. And we're asking how the for itself and the in itself get hooked up. And we do it by, and now I'm saying that this is the trick that Butler didn't allow, by infusing universality with being for self. That being for self is not always opposed to universality. That's the structure of the unhappy consciousness, subject and subjection.
But rather, there must be a way in which the in itself is also for itself, a mode of willing. So, this linking up of giving the moment of universality
a moment of being for self, this whole universality plus being for self, is what Hegel means by reason. Indeed, it's what anyone means by reason, one hopes. So, Harris says, but this identity of my will with God's will, of my being for self with objective universal, is precisely what is involved in rational thought and action. That is, what makes thought and action rational is that my particular will is infused with universality. What else could rational thought and action be but this joining of universality with particularity? This concept, reason equals rational thought and action, the concept of this identity, Harris says, is realized in the devout consciousness only as a momentary intuition, and even in that moment of absolution, the certainty of it is another's, and it is broken. Okay, so the sub thought here, it's called 3A, is that this is reason broken. And it's reason broken because for religious consciousness, it has this thought as a representation of a future state of affairs. So, it takes what is categorical and turns it into a hypothetical. If I surrender my will appropriately and I do what the priest tells me to do, then I will be unified with God. All of which is perfectly true. The if then is perfectly true. But the devout consciousness thinks of that if-then as a temporal coming to be and not as a logical claim. So you may say this is an act of false schematization. I say that only to annoy people who love the schema. This is an act of false schematization where we may say non-temporal logic is truer than the temporal logic. And it's as if, and Harris does this in a very religious way, it's as if it doesn't believe what itself is saying. You know, it will be done on earth as it is in heaven. As if there is a difference. It's still pretending there's a difference and unable to acknowledge. So this is what I called the moment of Luther rather than Descartes. It's reason all right, but broken because it still thinks there's a further something to be achieved. So Harris says, the next paragraph, but the act of absolution represents a rational syllogism.
The three terms are all necessary. It is not the personal or singular act of the priest. He is the mediating term through whom God's will is united with that of the penitent. The identity of my will with God's is reason. That thought, that the unity of my will with God's is reason, think of that as step four. Is the Descartes interpretation of the same phenomena. So, Harris says, for the devout consciousness, it exists in the inverted form of a representation, an object of thought. So representation now, and you're trying to get this idea, Vorstellung, it's also picture thinking here, that the notion of representation is a problem for Hegel. Because, well, why? Why is representation a problem for Hegel? Yeah? In part, there's a kind of fallacy, a misplaced concreteness.
Also, then static, not as an experience, as a question, but just means something that's stable.
Okay, so the first one was something very static about representation. That's right. Adam?
One of Pippin's ways of describing the transition from consciousness to subconsciousness is to say that how the world is massively, empirically, and metaphysically underdetermined.
Yep.
So the idea that you passively receive some kind of impression from the world that gives you a representation or project one through some kind of Kantian metaphysical substratum is false.
Right.
So I guess that's the static part that I'm trying to get at.
Mm-hmm.
The subject has to make them, and they're not something you can just set out once and for all. As this passive impression I got of how the world is, or the kind of transcendental conditions for my perception, there are things that change.
That's certainly absolutely part of it. So part of it is, that's right to say that the relationship between conceptual articulation of the world and the world is so massively underdetermined by the evidence that the notion of representation by itself looks static. But that we need some extra movement. Yeah.
What? Is it that the Lutheran broken moment is divided still, and the Cartesian one is a unity?
It certainly is divided, but between what and what? So representation, you're right to say, something about the very notion of representation is indicative of a divided. Why would it be indicative of a dividedness?
Is it required from misrecognition? Just the idea of setting something outside so that you can then see it and then misrecognizing it as an external.
Okay, so some part of the problem is the imaginary, which I take it is what Adam was driving at, is the imaginary of an outsideness that presents an independent criteria for adequacy. Representation, everything that's a representation, presupposes an object that exists independently of that representation, which that representation might match. And if what we're trying to say is because of the problem of underdetermination, that won't work, that we can't have an outsideness, then any representational account is going to operate on the basis of a fantasy. That is, a fantasy exactly of an independent real for which we can have an adequate accounting. And that's the very thought we already defeated back in consciousness. Right? So when we say that a certain form of encountering is representational, even at the level of reason, it turns out, right? Then we end up. So representation itself, and I don't know how to, I have to be delicate at this juncture, but everything about Hegel is a critique of representationalism. That the very idea of thinking that the way in which concepts articulate the world is by representing the world, exactly divides the world between for me and in itself. Every account of representation is divided, necessarily. Right? So as long as something is going to be representational, it's going to come up, it's going to come a cropper for Hegel. And Hegel's going to argue, but we're not going to get there to the very end of the chapter on religion, that religious thinking is intrinsically representational because of its conception of time. That is a bad theory of time. So at this point, you know, you can just hear all the ways in which Heidegger and Hegel have a very analogous thought, namely, as long as you think of time as spread out, as long as you think of the truth, for example, as in the future, what will be achieved, right? Then as long as you have that conception of time, then you will be representational. That is, that conception of time, namely as having three independent modalities, I want to express it that way, three independent modalities of present, past, and future, will end up becoming representation. So religious thinking is going to be burdened with an idea of the truth as having a twofold character, as both having already occurred, the incarnation. We've come, we've been saved. All you have to do is cross the Mason-Dixon line. Ask anyone, they'll tell you. It's already done. It's, you know. And as yet to come, the rapture. Right? So you get this duality, you know, of both an eternal present and this sense of eschatological futurity. The latter generates a representation. because it says there's a gap between how things are, what would count as our account of the world matching the truth of the world. Nonetheless,
since via steps 1 and 2, that we have a syllogism that generates via the mediator, so the plus here is the mediator, then we have reason.
Hence my claim that in order to imagine modernity happening, you have to imagine it happening under two different descriptions. Right? It turns out they're the two sides of Weber's secularization hypothesis, right? They are the spirit of Christianity as, or spirit of capitalism as, grounded in Protestant Christianity, right? You both have an absolute sense that is reason that is doing everything, and another sense at the same time that is still religious. And Hegel thought that duality between what is called the Protestant moment and the modern science capital moment, Hegel's going to talk about both. Exists side by side in the development of modernity. So, Harris concludes his chapter, not on your handout, by saying the story of chapter 5, the next chapter, is of how the singular consciousness. And notice what's happened here. My will. This is Luther. Here I stand and can do no other. Cogito ergo sum. So universality is taken to be the unique possession of an individual. So the next chapter on reason is going to be the story of how the singular conscious finds that by itself it cannot think and act
in the name of universality. That a singular consciousness on its own cannot be the true bearer of universality. But the fantasy that an individual could be the bearer of universality is, of course, the fantasy exactly of every rationalist, of Descartes, of Leibniz, of Spinoza, of Kant, of Fichte, and so on. But all these are the fantasy that... And so the next chapter is going to be an attempt to look at both qua science and qua action, how in modernity individuals have taken themselves to be qua individuals possessors of reason or universality. What that's meant, how they have acted on that idea and try to translate it into truth. So the chapter on reason is the chapter of individualism. So we know from the beginning that it's wrong. Hey, it happened. It's part of our history. And part of a history that, right, reverberates. Okay, that's how I take the transition to occur.
questions, thoughts, worries about that? I guess the argument would have to be that all conversions looking forward prospectively are arbitrary. That rationality is historically always backward looking. That's exactly the kind of story that, in fact, Kuhn and Lakatos tell us, right? That, you know, the answer, you know, that Kuhn gives is to exactly how the Newtonians defeat the Aristotelians. The Aristotelians all die. That's all. which is to say, but this goes very deeply to your point, and is part of the problem of the structure of Hegel's text. We are stubborn creatures. We very, very rarely change our minds. The more threat we're under, the temptation is to get more and more dogmatic and stubborn rather than to become rational and reflective and change our minds. And Hegel is not an idealist about people changing their minds, right? He realizes that these shifts are conversions, and that from the inside, let me be clear about it, from the inside, there may be sufficient grounds for despair, but rarely are there sufficient grounds for change. That's why the text requires a two-leveled account between natural consciousness and philosophical consciousness. If natural consciousness could do it all by itself, right, then he could have done a true, pure phenomenology, right? Just follow natural consciousness, and natural consciousness will, you know, collapse and will think of better ideas. It doesn't work like that. So what Hegel has to do is show, and I want to be clear, that, and this is how also, this is important because this is also how Marx misread Hegel. Hegel's contention is that there are, whatever the actual reason for historical change are, there are necessary and sufficient endogenous reasons for a form of consciousness to collapse. Step one. So internally, that is endogenous. Internally, it's all endogenous here, internally, there really are grounds for
all these various forms of consciousness to implode. And secondly, that there are successive forms of consciousness which stand up to the criteria of determinate negation with respect to the previous one. What he doesn't claim is that the actual transformation can be conceived of as an unfolding endogenous movement. That's how Marx misread him. Marx misread Hegel to be claiming that Hegel was saying that reason is working itself out in history as if reason were an independent force or power achieving all these things. Right? But Hegel never claims that. His claim is much weaker. That's why this is a phenomenology of consciousness and not an empirical history of consciousness. Right? Hegel's only claiming that there is a reconstruction of our history and of the structures of that history that matches this structure of endogenous collapse and determinate transformation. And Hegel thinks that's enough. Remember what he says in the introduction. Who undergoes experience here? That is the transition from one form of consciousness to another. We do. I mean, it's in fact us who are getting educated by this structure. Remember what he says. He says natural consciousness doesn't have an education. It has misery. It just goes through one damned despair after another. Right? The story of natural consciousness is a story of... I'm reading Zabold at the moment. It makes perfect sense. Nothing but... Right, one disaster after another. You know, this is pure. So in a way, you know, Benjamin Zabel had it right. You know, it's just a string of despairs. But Hegel says there's a way of construing it, of construing that series, that shows it also has a logically internal structure. So compare... one way of getting at this very moment we're talking about, the book worth reading for all good aliens, is Blumenberg on the legitimacy of the modern age. And Blumenberg is exactly in dialogue with Heidegger. Heidegger thinks that modernity, the very moment we're looking at, is a mere act of self-assertion. That what you get with Descartes is a kind of self-will against what? Against disclosure or something, right? And what Blumenberg's argument is, in much more detail than the 17 minutes I've given it here, endless, is that the Middle Ages were full of unresolved problems and difficulties and intellectual challenges, and roughly in a very kind of Kuhnian way, was going through a series of reaching a point where their paradigms were becoming, right, anomalous. Couldn't hold it together. And that the uprising of Galileo, of Descartes, of Newton, solved the problems. And they weren't just irrational eruptions of the will, scientizing the world, right? Mechanizing it, ruining it forever, they actually solved a whole bunch of problems about meaning, about truth, and blah, 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 and about how the physical world works that the Middle Ages couldn't handle. some aspect of that, some other aspect that Bloomberg talked about. That's the way I think of work. Is that, have I answered it, or have I sidestepped?
I only wonder why these forms have such a huge temptation and recalcitrance that they still posit themselves as being ultimately authoritative. You still find Catholics who claim that they are far more sophisticated than Protestants and so on. You wouldn't find an Aristotelian who would claim that he's far more sophisticated than Einstein. And
well,
Ben Grazini's PhD makes me that, but anyway, I take it the phenomenology is in one respect like the whole of Kant's dialectic. If you consider Kant's dialectic as an account of the temptations of reason to do false things, what Hegel has to convince you of is that none of these are mere mistakes. That they have to be more than mere temptations, they have to be powerful temptations. Right? And when we begin to analyze, for example, what makes Protestantism superior to Catholicism from an Hegelian perspective, we'll have to do something that Kuhn does very well, namely, with every movement forward, there are also losses. Hegel doesn't talk about the losses, but there are obvious losses in the movement of Protestantism. Namely, Protestantism, as we read about the Episcopal Church at the moment, going through another perennial crisis. Why? Because if you have a form of worship in which each individual is formally equivalent to a priest, then you're going to have a problem with institutional structures. So the power of Catholicism has been twofold. First, iconoclasm stinks. That is. No. I mean, this is, if you want to know, if you, part of the whole, this would be a whole course, I think you could show that all continental philosophy is really about iconoclasm. Roughly, the Germans are all iconoclasts, while the French all believe in pictures. Right? Because the French are Catholics and the Germans are Protestants. It's nothing more than that. Right? So you read Kristeva, she's a good Catholic, right? It just so happens that Catholicism looks a lot like Freud. It doesn't matter, right? It all works out at the level of sensuousness of musicality, of sound, right? All of that Catholicism is there in Irigaray. All of it. Right? Any good German, iconoclastic. That's idolatry. Now these are powerful differences. These are not thin differences, and they're deep problems. Right? Which Hegel, as we'll see, Hegel has to square all this. But the obvious thing I want to say is there's a tremendous loss in the movement to Lutheranism, and in the movement from Lutheranism into rationalism, maybe the institutional and the sensuous get displaced in all sorts of problematic ways. Right? And those problems of institution and problems of what's called representation, right, will turn out to haunt the French Revolution. Right? They actually turn out to be political problems. So, although Hegel doesn't say much about it, we have to both be able to see the power of each movement. Hence, one reason for spending a year on this book, rather than trying to rush through it and get the overview, is to try to give yourself a chance to become an unhappy consciousness for a bit. To feel the weight of that claim, and therefore feel the weight of what surrendering it involves. So I think I would say that these things, and Hegel is, and of course, because Hegel thinks that actuality precedes universality, right? Hegel is an Aristotelian. That's the metaphysical line we're going to keep harping on. Actuality precedes universality. Then, of course, I can't go to the person who doesn't believe and start with some neutral, okay, we agree. A equals A. Let's deduce the world. We can't do that. Right? Because we're always grounded in actuality, and these actualities impinge upon us. So it seems to me that Hegel has a powerful account of that Hegel's way of philosophizing actually allows for exactly what your question, namely, to think hard about the resistance to modernity, the resistance to reason, the resistance to change, and the power of the death drive.
Yeah.
I just wanted to stay on Hume for a second. Hume never posits like an endpoint like Hegel does, right? Like you never presume there's going to be a culmination.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I know, it seems like in Hegel's transitions there's no logical necessity, but it seems like there's some other kind of necessity, I guess, that he's touched on. And I don't know, could you tell us maybe? Maybe you've gone over it before, but just kind of the nature of what that is. Is it just compelling to so many people that it takes over? You see what I'm saying? It's not logically necessary, these transitions, right?
Well, they're not logically arbitrary either. He's trying to transform what we think about rationality and how it operates. And he will eventually be trying to convince us to give up representational ways of thinking and become to think of ourselves as self-interpreting, right?
But I'm saying, is it just luck that it ends up being the right, the thing that moves us forward?
Is it just luck? It's from the point of view of causality, it's just luck. But there are reasons, and if you want, as it were, it's actually not Hegel, but it's much more you'll find in Weber, I would think, an account that explains why these intellectual transformations actually had causal efficacy in the world. So it's the Nietzschean Weberian story that actually is going to give a more causal account. But moving to a similar conclusion.
Okay, yeah. I have a question about the feeling, because in the unhappy consciousness, two times he mentioned the feeling. One is the first stage in that devotion. That's
musical consciousness.
He said it's not thinking, but because in the devotion, that's paragraph 217, mm-hmm. In the middle of 217, and he said I didn't think about this universality, this other side, but I just feel it. Mm-hmm. And also in the second stage, in this sacramental walking, then mm-hmm. in paragraph 220, it's mm-hmm. also about the feeling of some self-independence.
Yep.
So this feeling he means here just some kind of, it still doesn't reach the level of consciousness of thinking, and it's just an intermediate stage. And but meanwhile, this is also necessary, kind of the necessary force or necessary movement towards the consciousness and the thinking, towards yeah. the thinking. But is this, in fact, in his whole book, he very seldom mentions the feeling. And he just mentions desire or these things. So I just want to know what's his what's the role of feeling in his whole system.
We were fine up until that last page. But it gives me a nice chance to say something I've been wanting to say. For weeks, I'm having to say, frame what I'm going to say, which is this, that something I've mentioned but I need to underline, that one of the staggering disappointments in reading this book is that Hegel doesn't have a theory of anything. Right? That somehow, but this is part of the problem of the book, because theories are representations of the truth of things. So a theory is, what is feeling, right? Let's have a theory of feeling in relationship to, you know, language, consciousness, awareness. So we're going to get a general account of feeling in its role. Not here. So a little bit in the Encyclopedia of Philosophy of Mind, a little bit, but not much. But in this text, there's not an account of feeling, or consciousness, or reason, or the state, or intersubjectivity, or recognition. There are no theories of anything. And that is part of what he's trying to get us away from, is thinking that what philosophy does is offer theories, right? I mean, that's kind of what maybe psychology does, but it's not the job of philosophy to give an account of feeling. So what happens in the phenomenology is that feeling will crop up at just those moments when it actually has been orientational for human self-understanding. So there turn out to be moments, we're going to find one in the next section, on the purity of heart, you know, a kind of Rousseauian moment of feeling. And religion will keep having moments of feeling, and so on. There's going to be actually a lot of moments where feeling plays a role. But it's going to play a role because it is going to belong to a form of consciousness. And the significance of feeling is going to be that this form of... And so what? But feeling, of course, always has certain characteristics for Hegel. Feelings are not raw. And you say raw. Feelings are not raw. They are conceptual. They are contextual. They have objects. They have a structure. So feelings are always determinate feelings. But feelings are an inward response to something. That is, feelings are, for Hegel, a refusal of objectification, an attempt to preserve or hold on to a moment of inwardness, and therefore an attempt to sanction or legitimate a moment where my sense of myself, let's call it a version of self-certainty. So every version of feeling is going to be a version of self-certainty, becomes orientational. Now that does mean that for Hegel, feeling is both necessary for our encounter with the world, because unless you have a inner feeling response, you're going to be dealing with something not as an individual, but as it were abstractly. So feeling both has a certain necessity, and as he indicates here, a certain necessary inadequacy. That is, it refuses the moment of negation, refuses the moment of death, refuses the moment of reflection. So feeling is always a hope of avoiding reflection. Which anyone who's ever talked to anyone who said, but I feel it, right? You know that means I'm not going to think, I refuse to think, thinking is done with here, right? Feeling is a code word, right, for stubborn inwardness.
Meanwhile, although it's kind of insufficient certainty, but meanwhile it's unnecessary. Yeah, because only when I feel it, I begin to work, try to get into mediation, try to reach that side. So therefore, feeling, and then I compare it with desire. So desire is also such intention to get that, get other side, get something outside of you. But then feeling is kind of rather from this consciousness side, like this. It just means I'm not certain. I'm not clear what it is. Therefore, I begin to reach it via desire. It's rather.
Well,
basic.
I think what I want to say is that, and I'm now just working on memory, but I'm pretty sure the way feeling crops up is it's always as a certain form of refuge for a threatened moment of inwardness. It's an attempt to locate or find or specify a certain kind of inwardness and hold on to it. People are getting thirsty. Let's have a wine break, whatever kind of drug you wish. And we'll begin again in kind of 10 minutes. From there and finish the pizza.
We're good.